Greetings, hello, and welcome out there in podcast land. You have reached Johnny Has the Keys. Hopefully it is your favorite podcast that you listen to. It's a podcast about genre pieces, horror, science fiction, literature, those things that have connections and that we talk about. My name's David, and I'm here with my good friend Tim. Hey, Tim, how are you?
Hello, David. Sorry.
Are you coming all the way from England?
I am.
Oh, no. Oh, Scotland.
Actually, Scotland. The land Scotland. Of human sacrifice.
Oh, now you've given away the whole movie. Oh, bother.
Oh, sorry. I was just thinking of druids. Druids and Stonehenge.
Oh, sometimes I wake up thinking of druids. How have you been? What have you been doing this week?
I have been fine. As far as genre related incidents, I'm still obsessed with Outsider. We've talked about it. We've decided we're going to do a bonus podcast for Patreon on it once it's finished airing
definitely.
On HBO. We still have a few episodes mm-hmm. left. So I'm going to dwell on death again. I mentioned sacrifice earlier. And in the last episode, I mentioned the passing of Terry Jones. But this week, I wanted to mention a couple of passings of legendary TV actors. And those two actors would be Robert Conrad and John Carlin. I'm sure that they both probably ring a bell with you as they did me.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up as a kid obsessed with two shows. One of them was Star Trek and the other was The Wild Wild West. And Robert Conrad was the Shatner equivalent of Wild Wild West, basically.
Yes.
And it had a science fiction element.
I wanted his high-waisted britches really badly.
I wanted in his high-waisted britches, but
oh my God!
yeah, that was what it did to a little kid like me. You know, seeing somebody running and always ripping them too. He was always splitting those pants because they were way tight. But anyway, that show had a science fiction element, and it was a Western. And I really never thought of this, but one of my favorite writers is. Joe Lansdale, and he has often crossed into Western territory with horror and or science fiction. So I never really put the two together. But I guess my love for that kind of thing started with this show and Mr. Conrad. So he will be missed.
It was a very steampunk sort of feel before steampunk was even a thing.
Right.
You know, it was essentially a science fiction television show, even though it was set in the West.
Mm-hmm. And their bat cave was like a train.
Yeah. And you had Artemis doing all of those different crazy disguises and makeups. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I always remembered Miguelito Loveless, the little villain, the little person who was a villain.
Yes. That you should mention that, but... it has nothing to do with this podcast today, but it has to do with another podcast. I was going to bring him up, that actor that played Loveless. But we'll get to that later.
Okay.
Long live Robert Conrad. And then, of course, John Carlin. Here lately, I've mentioned a documentary on Dan Curtis, and I've talked often about Dark Shadows and how they still tour and do those conventions, fan conventions. And John Carlin pretty much got his start as Willie on Dark Shadow. Excuse me. I started to say Willie Loomis, but his name's not Willie Loomis, is it? Actually, it may be Willie Loomis.
It may.
Anyway.
That I don't know.
His name was Willie. He's the one that unearthed Barnabas from his crypt. He later went on to star on Cagney and Lacey with Sharon Gless and... the other one, I can't remember her name, and he won Tyne Daly, sorry, and he won an Emmy for that show, I do believe. So both of these were like diehard television actors. These were not your typical movie actors. They were television heroes of mine. So Hate to see the passing of those two. That was what was on my mind this week. What's on your mind?
Well, I guess I'm continuing in my trying to catch up on different movies that I've missed. And so since it was such a huge controversy and, you know, first ever thing at the Oscars, I ended up saying I had to watch Parasite because I literally knew nothing about it except it was from South Korea.
I am so excited. About the movie. Totally. You are watching foreign films without me. That's awesome.
And I watched a foreign film without you. And I have very mixed feelings. I actually think I'm going to have to watch it again.
Okay.
Because it is not... I don't even really want to talk to you about it because I'd love for you to get your take on it because... like I said, I knew nothing about it. I didn't know, is it a horror movie? Is it a science fiction movie? Is it a comedy? What is it? I don't, you know, with a name like Parasite, naturally I assumed I'm going to be watching, you know, David Cronenberg or something.
Right. I'm getting it confused, maybe. But I know there's a popular Asian movie out there that deals with a loved one dying and the family members acting like nothing is wrong. Is that the one or am I thinking of a different one?
That must be a different one.
Okay, never mind then. I don't know what Parasite's about then.
But yeah, I'd be curious for you to see it. It's very interesting. Okay. And
well, it won Best Picture.
Yeah. I know. And part of me, I mean, for most of the movie, I was sitting there going, why was this even nominated? Let alone, how could it possibly ever win?
Because you wanted Joker to win.
Yeah. I really did.
So if you didn't think it should win and you didn't think Joker should win, what should have? Because I have no idea even now what was nominated.
Well, I think probably 1917 overall probably should have won, even though I haven't seen it yet.
So yeah, I can't really tell you,
but it's, I mean, predominantly most of it looks like it's one shot for one thing. So, I mean, that's a challenge in and of itself. But I think the overall production values, storytelling, from what I've heard, is just brilliant.
Yeah,
so
you're not the first to tell me that.
Probably.
Yeah, I've heard that too.
I think it probably should have won, but for some fluke of nature, we decided to make the best Oscar a not even an American movie. So that was first time ever.
And, you know, I don't have a problem with that if it's good. I just assumed it was really good. I haven't seen it, so I don't know. Isn't 1917 Sam Mendes?
Yep.
The guy that did, that's Mr. Kate Winslet. Yeah.
Yeah, Mr. Kate Winslet. Yeah. Yeah.
He did American Beauty, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
I'm curious.
And he also did Parasite. He also did essentially the revival of James Bond. He did Spectre,
Casino Royale.
And he did Casino Royale.
Oh, nice. Like that movie.
Great visual director and very good. I don't know. I'm going to have to watch it again before I make up my mind totally. But I'm leaning more toward, I just don't get it. I just don't get it. How did you think this was the best picture? But there are, you know, I did see a tweet from the current administration and his reaction was, why did they give it to South Korea? We have enough trouble with them anyway. Whatever happened to movies like Gone with the Wind? And I thought, oh my God.
All right, first of all, I love that movie and I love that book, but I do see how it is politically incorrect right now. Or probably forever.
No crap.
Right, right.
And in doing it in the same tweet as we have enough trouble with South Korea. I'm like, what?
No,
North Korea is the one with the bombs, you moron.
The real issue here is why would anyone, well, I shouldn't even go here. Why would anyone even want movie advice from Donald Trump?
True. So very true. I mean, his television show was so good. anyway.
So, yeah, there was the, I was going to dwell just a minute on the Oscars. You know, they've been getting a lot of flack because of Oscars so white without a lot of women and minorities in roles. So it did seem to me when I watched the show, and I did watch the show, that they were going out of their way to have diverse diverse presenters and diverse winners. And I thought, okay, maybe that's why Parasite's winning, is they're trying to shed this image. But I thought that it was probably a pretty good movie too. So I guess I'll have to check it out.
Well, yeah, but I mean, out of all the stuff out there, they couldn't nominate even one female director?
Right.
I mean, I thought that was weird.
That's what I'm saying. I think they were trying to cover up for that. I think they realized they fucked up, and that's why they were doing everything else maybe they could. But I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there was, but there were great movies out there. I mean, there was, you know, even Tarantino. He had Once Upon a Time in Hollywood was out.
That's the one I want to see.
Marriage Story
more than
one
any
that I've heard was really good.
Yeah.
Scorsese has Irishman out. I mean, so they have all these movies are out, and yet they ended up, you know, giving the best actor to Joaquin Phoenix and giving the best actress to Renee Zellweger. What? Really? But anyway.
Yeah.
We digress.
We do. And I mean, I want to see a Judy Garland movie, but I don't know that I want to see her playing Judy Garland because I'm not a fan. And Joaquin,
she might be fine. She might be awesome in it. I don't know. I haven't seen it.
I haven't either. But I don't know that I've liked Joaquin in anything since Gladiator. And that's a long time. So.
Yep. I'm right with you on that one.
Yeah. Oh, well. But, we dwell. Yeah,
Charlize. Charlize was nominated. I mean, come on. You can always give it to her.
Mm-hmm.
Anything for her is great, but but anyway, so that was my genre take this week. I'm hoping to dive back into something that I'll actually next week say, hey, I really, really love this or like it, but we'll see.
But was it a genre take? It really is. It's not a genre movie, is it? Or is it?
I think you need to watch it.
Okay.
I can't really. I don't want to give you any preconceptions because I went into it totally blind.
Well, I mean, because I would be really happy if another horror movie won Best Picture, but I don't think it's a horror movie.
I think there are people that describe it as a horror movie. Yes.
Okay.
But ironically, there are others that describe it as a comedy. So there you go. Hence my struggle.
Okay.
So
very good.
But we'll see. We'll see from there. Let's see. What is it we're talking about this week, though, Tim? I think we're going to
talk
Scotland
about white men on a very white country, in a very white country.
Yeah.
So nothing diverse here.
Yeah, there's no diversity now. We're going back in time, so that's okay.
We're going to talk about a movie that came out in 1973. I have very fond memories of this movie. I will discuss them momentarily. It is called The Wicker Man. It is what looks like it could be a Hammer film, but it's not. It's from a company called British Lion. And it is about a Scottish officer that goes to a Scottish island, or I guess an island off the coast, in search of a missing girl named, what's her name, David?
Rowan Morrison. I'm looking for Rowan Morrison.
I'm here looking for Rowan Morrison. She's been missing. She's been reported missing. And as this police officer investigates this strange little Scottish island named Summer Isle, he starts to notice peculiar things. He's a little bit of a prude, but it's kind of hard when it's juxtaposed with walking outside and occasionally seeing people fornicating on the lawn at night. Anyway, odd things are going on, and basically it leads up to this island. I don't know what to say without giving too much away. Is kind of a pagan island, and they practice a pagan religion. And he is a Christian, and he is aghast at what he sees and what they're teaching their kids. And during his search for Rowan, he unearths far more than he bargained for. And we'll just leave it at that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Do you remember?
That's a pretty good synopsis.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm not going to be able to shake the British thing. I know I'm not.
Well, no, we're in Scotland.
What? I want to know what your earliest memory of this movie is. I'm assuming you saw it before.
Interesting you start
last
with
night.
That. Interesting you start with that and ask that, because up until last night when I watched it, I had this movie confused. And I think I have it confused with Dunwich Horror.
Oh.
And I thought that was what it was. And I honestly can't remember if I ever had seen this movie until last night. Because literally nothing stuck out. No scene, no graphic, nothing. I mean, the design of the Wicker Man at the end, but I have seen images of that and pictures of that, and, you know, Christopher Lee standing in front of it and everything.
Well,
so
and you would remember Britt Eklund, too. I know you.
Well, yes.
I mean, she dances around in a room nude for like 5 minutes, so it's kind of hard to forget.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I didn't remember that. So I thought, I don't think I had ever seen this movie
until then.
So I had had memories of it from all of the lists and being in, you know, in genre, you know, related stuff all my life. So I've heard of, you know, cult classic and Incredible and, oh, you don't want to miss The Wicker Man and, you know, that sort of thing.
It is the Citizen Kane of horror movies, according to Sin Fantastic magazine. And that was a magazine you used to read.
That was a magazine I loved. Yeah. That was one of my, and now I've totally lost faith in it because I don't think this is the Citizen Kane of horror movies.
Even when I read that quote, I laughed. I love this movie, but it is not the Citizen Kane of horror movies. It is a very iconic movie and a very, I mean, it has its place in horror movie history for sure. I mean, it's its own subgenre.
Okay, then let me ask you, do you think it has its place in horror movie history because of the cult aspects of it, from, you know, the history of it and the history after it and trying to get distributed and yada yada after that? Or do you think the story, the movie itself, has a place in horror iconography?
I'm not sure I understood what you were asking. Are you saying...
Well, like...
Because of the...
Like, example...
The hype
Evil
or the,
Dead.
The actual...
Evil Dead, product. I think... Evil Dead, people call a cult classic... and I think it has a cult classic for two reasons. I think it's a cult classic because it was endorsed by Stephen King. It got picked up. It was this little bitty independent thing that blew everybody away when it was finally watched. But it's also a cult classic just because the movie itself is different, unique, very kind of set its own genre almost, or subgenre, I guess, is what we've described it as. Do you think Wicker Man is like that as well? Or do you think it's like, you know, people say Zardoz is a cult classic. Zardoz is not a cult classic. It's just a weird freaking film. It's not a cult classic.
No, I would call Zardoz maybe a good bad movie, but not a classic.
Yeah,
no.
Should be.
This I would definitely call a classic. I would call this a classic similar to the way we would call Night of the Living Dead a classic, because it basically, if it didn't start its own subgenre, it is a very early landmark in that subgenre of folk pagan horror. When we get to Keys, I have a lot of literature that more than likely came out before it. But, and it's funny that you mentioned Dunwich Horror, because I was going to write that down, and I was like, is this really pagan? And then I said, well, you know, it is kind of a cult with the Cthulhu mythos. So, yeah. And there is, like, a sacrifice in Dunwich Horror as well, or in the movie, at least. But as far as, yeah, as far as it being a landmark or what I would consider a large film in the horror genre, it would be because it is unique in its own subgenre of, and I do find this movie terrifying. You can watch it now and there are hilarious moments. I mean, Christopher Lee running around in drag, skipping down the street is pretty fucking funny, but the end is still one of the most terrifying things I can think of. Because...
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, I also think I've probably had dreams like that, where all of a sudden I was helpless and there was no way I was getting out. And...
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I don't know. I just find the end of this movie so bleak and sad and scary, and you just want him to kick out of that burning thing and shoot some of them people, you know.
Well, he can't shoot them, lad. He doesn't have a weapon. You know, police officers in England don't carry weapons.
He could bust them with his stick. I don't know.
With your nightstick.
So yeah. So what? You know, I didn't say it in the synopsis, but basically what happens is Rowan Atkinson is not, or not Rowan Atkinson, Rowan Morgan, what is it? I can't remember the damn girl's name.
Morrison! Rowan Morrison!
She turns out not to be missing.
You're all a bunch of little liars.
Yeah, she turns out not to be missing. She's actually a decoy they use to lead this virginal officer to the island to sacrifice. And basically he plays into their hands almost as if it was written that way in one of their sacred texts or whatever. He's the fool. He's the virgin. He stumbles into their cult, you know, with the motive of finding this girl, and ends up being the final piece to their sacrifice in hopes of bringing, you know, good crops the following year. And he is burned alive in a giant wicker man with a bunch of animals and other offerings. Yeah, that, I don't know. It that terrifies me alone in itself. So that's another reason.
Well, I have to admit, I went into this. I went into this with all the hype around it. You know, some people call it, you know, one of the top 10. British horror movies of all time. People call it a cult classic. It's very, very well respected in the horror world, I think. And as a horror movie goes, I have to say by the end of it, I wasn't scared once. I didn't, you know, I guess because I basically could see through it really quickly, and knew what was happening, maybe. Which surprised me because it's written by Anthony Sheffer, who wrote one of my favorite plays of all time, Sleuth.
Right.
And is a very good writer. I mean, as far as plots go and storytelling and kind of keeping an audience, you know, understanding an audience. He's a very good, strong playwright. And so I thought, wow, he wrote it? This will be very interesting. I can't wait to... But, you know, most of the first, like, 30 minutes in between, I'm looking for Rowan Morrison. She's a young girl who disappeared from this island. And he says it 19 times. In between that and wandering out and looking at weird, hearing weird musical numbers, it wasn't very well written, I didn't think. And I was going, okay, it wasn't until Christopher Lee actually came into it that I thought, okay, now something's happening. And it was really, but I never was scared in the entire time. And I guess that's because paganism doesn't scare me in any way. I mean, I think the thought of human sacrifice is an ancient rite. So I think it happens, it has happened for thousands of years. So it doesn't really kind of freak me out, I guess.
Well, it doesn't happen really in the modern world that we know of, or we don't see it. So when it
you can't tell anyone. Don't mention it.
So when all of a sudden you're a part of it, it is a complete and total surprise.
Anyway. Yeah, I think maybe if I had, because you kind of described it immediately, you said he's kind of a prude. I think if I had seen a little, maybe just a hair more development of him at the beginning, like, you know, maybe there's a scene with him. Maybe you start out with him as a scene at church before he gets in his plane or something. So I get just a little bit more of his.
They do show him praying.
Very
strong.
They show him
praying at his bedside.
Yeah, but that's after we've already seen him go, I'm looking for Rowan Morrison. No. That's that night.
Yeah.
And, it's like bedtime prayers to me. I didn't seem to be part of his spirituality. It came out later.
Yeah.
I guess maybe, I don't know. I kept thinking, what is making people vested in this movie?
Well, I think, first of all, one of the reasons, and you discovered you may have seen it for the first time last night.
Right.
I think it's the same reason people had trouble with Midsommar is that maybe they had not seen this movie and they didn't know what was going on. It's because of
this
movie.
Now that I've seen it, mm-hmm. Now that I've seen it, I think you're right in that it created it, because I can't think of another movie prior to it in the 60s or 50s, but it created the pagan sacrificial subgenre, you know, of this cult will do anything to perpetuate itself,
right?
Kind of thing. That's definitely in Midsommar and you know, since
and so
then,
you knew
in Rosemary's
you
Baby,
knew going into it because of Midsommar how it was gonna end, basically. But to see this movie for the very first time in 1973, I think it probably freaked people out that could get past the hippie.
See, I don't
mumbo
see how
jumbo.
It could when you have that. I don't see how it could freak people out when it's suddenly right at a moment when it could have been either kind of scary or creepy. They go into a freaking musical number. That was just weird. The music all the way through it threw me off and was just freaking weird.
Yeah, I have one note that just says the music is terrible.
Yeah.
It is.
And then there are other times where I thought I was watching a 60s porno. You know, I'm going, this is soft core. This would be a good drive-in movie, I guess. Uh-huh. But then even that doesn't fulfill in the end.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I was ready for some pagan rituals, you know, there at the end, around the bonfire and stuff. But no, we didn't get that. We got them kind of swaying on the mountaintop kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me tell you about my first memory of this movie.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
I don't know if you remember this, but University of Tennessee used to have a little cinema where you could, it was in the student lounge or student whatever.
Oh, yeah.
Student center. And we used to go there and watch free movies. And the two movies I remember seeing there are both iconic movies in their own regard. And one was this. And it, you know, it was only 10 years after it had come out. It was in 1983. So this, you know, had only been out 10 years. And so it shocked the shit out of me because I wasn't expecting it. But then I also saw at another time in this very same theater, I saw Pink Flamingos, which was John Waters' crazy guerrilla film making technique.
Mm-hmm.
And in both movies, you know, one's a horror movie. One's a, I don't know what you call it, a dark comedy. Both movies have explicit nudity in them, X-rated nudity in them. I mean, this one's got, well, it's not Brit. It's Brit from the waist up. But when she turns around, it's a body double shaking her ass at the camera. And then in Pink Flamingos, you know, Divine goes down on her son and is filleting him. And I'm like, that's porn. How in the hell did this get in a movie? You know? But so that's my first memory, is that I saw this on a college campus. And I was like, why did they choose this for the students to watch? I wonder.
Well, it was marketed almost like an art movie, right?
I mean,
I could see this more as an art movie experiment than I could as a horror movie.
Well, even. And I watched
Except,
go ahead.
It's very, except all of the dialogue and the justification of the old religion and paganism and everything that Christopher Lee goes on is very intellectual. Uh-huh. But again, I guess that may appeal to a college crowd too, mm-hmm. especially in the 70s. So that kind of makes sense, yeah. I guess.
I watched a behind the scenes. I actually texted it to you. I don't know if you saw it. And they interviewed mm-hmm. Roger Corman because Roger Corman wanted to distribute it in America. And he said, I saw it as part art film, part horror movie. Because, you know, it was new to them,
too. I could
definitely
see that.
They had never seen anything like it. We've been rambling here for a while, but we haven't really got into any of the background. There is a lot of this movie that was shot that doesn't exist anymore. It has to do with somebody potentially named Michael Dealey, who was the managing director of British Lion, not getting along with Christopher Lee. And Christopher Lee says this is his favorite film and his favorite role. But Michael Dealey disagreed. He had Roger Corman wanted to distribute it. He couldn't, for some reason, distribute it. But then Michael Dealey went to Roger and had Roger edit it to make it shorter and play better. And I think any of those scenes that got cut out, and there were a lot that I'm sure were horrible nude music parts because there's a lot of weird music and, like, dancing around in this movie. But some of it is speeches that Christopher Lee gave. And that's one of the reasons Christopher Lee and Michael Dealey do not get along is because he cut a large chunk of Christopher Lee's presence in this movie. And apparently they're saying, I'm not sure what the exact deal is, but that these reels ended up in a vault that somehow got buried under the M3, whatever the motorway is in Britain.
Yeah, the M3.
Yeah. It mm-hmm. became like, you know, just tossed out in the trash and paved over by a road. So apparently the Wicker Man exists under a highway in England somewhere. The real version.
Yeah, the negatives, right? Because this was when Shepherd and Studio was being bought or something, wasn't it? Or something was really, it was in that weird time frame in 73 when England was going through weird cinematic industrial stuff. Mm-hmm. People were trying to either become big tycoons and take over all the studios like Shepherd and Pinewood or whatever. I remember that from film history. But I think you're right. It's about that same time. But yeah, they said that there's only one cut of it, or there was other cuts of it that aren't, or something.
Right.
Can't remember.
And they keep the interview I saw with Lee, he swears the film still exists out there. He is in denial about it not, about a full version being out there. He doesn't think it's destroyed. Everyone else thinks it's lost. But I thought that was interesting. I told you about my memories at UT with it. It was filmed in Galloway, Scotland, which was really bleak, and they filmed it in the fall, and it's set in the spring, so most of them were freezing. I'm sure you can relate, being on the Evil Dead set.
mm-hmm. I totally understand
You know,
that.
With naked women running around in, you know, October in Scotland. So that was going on. I told you about the Citizen Kane thing. Anyway, they ended up, they were filming Don't Look Now, which is another classic horror film with Donald Sutherland and, is it Julia Christie, I think? It's based on a Daphne du Maurier novel. Anyway, Don't Look Now was being kind of frowned upon as far as their production, too. So since they didn't like Don't Look Now and they didn't like The Wicker Man, they stuck them on a double bill and sent them out into the world. And I think both of them pretty much tanked. And now both of them are regarded as classics. So there you go. And Don't Look Now was Nicholas Roeg, I believe. I'm pretty sure.
Anyway. Well, and I guess also thinking about it being I'm trying to again justify this whole hype of it being this incredible classic. And I guess, you know, it was a a cult movie that had nothing to do with Satan. Because I know in the 70s or late 60s, 70s, there were a lot of Satan worship movies. Mm-hmm. You know, there was a lot of, you know, Dunwich Horror feels satanic, even though it's not. But, you know, there was a lot of that Satan cults or whatever. And this one isn't that at all. It's very earth, Wiccan, you know, kind of feel to it.
Yeah. When I was looking for keys, and believe me, I have an abundance, but when I was looking for some additional ones, I just Googled pagan horror, trying to find stuff. And a lot of satanic mm-hmm. stuff comes up. And I'm like, that's not really what I'm looking for. Just like you say, it's really not the same. I think satanic horror is a little darker.
Yeah, and I think it's very easy for people to be more scared in a or more standoffish in a satanic one, because satanic we also. But ideally, though, if you think about witches, like we talked about The Witch, I think earlier this season, and that movie scared the shit out of me. Mm-hmm. But that was pagan. That wasn't satanic. It was, well, although they kept, I can't ever remember what's the name of the damn goat.
Black Philip.
Billy. Black.
Yeah, I will say that till I go to my grave. I love saying it. I chant it. I skip around my house singing it. Black Philip.
But he's, you know, I guess that's the devil. So it could be satanic. But, you know, everybody's accused of being a witch.
Well, and that movie came up a lot in my searches, too. When I searched for pagan horror, The Witch.
The Witch?
Yeah, it came up a lot. Mm-hmm. And they also used the words folk horror, which I find kind of a little off-putting. Strange.
I mean, you probably could say it's the only cult horror movie with folk music in it.
Well, and that's just the times. I mean, it was practically the 60s, and there is some really bad music in this. And at one point, the director, Robin Hardy, said, "We're making a musical." And everyone was like looking at each other like, "What the fuck's he talking about?" But he did keep a lot of that music in. Now, I was okay with the Mayday stuff when they're spinning around the pole and stuff, but like the singing in the bar and all that stuff was a little... what's the word? It's not redundant. It's not necessary.
It pulls you right out of the movie.
Yeah, yeah.
It pulls you right out of the experience. The Landlord's Daughter song. Now, I would probably, if it had not had the weird music at the beginning when he's walking around the town, and the weird music in the bar, if they had just had the Maypole song, it probably would have creeped me out. Mm-hmm. Because that song was kind of weird. Mm-hmm. And you're listening to all these kids sing this song about, you know, essentially a pagan sex rite.
Right.
And you're like going, really? The guy's on top of her? And okay. Mm-hmm. Sing that, kids. Go ahead.
I will say one thing about the music that I thought was extremely effective is, and I know this because I've seen this movie like a half a dozen times, when you know it's the day of the sacrifice, and you hear that slow drum, doom, doom, and that's how that day begins. And you're like, yeah, it's coming. Especially if you've seen it before.
Oh, for May Day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
I thought the music was used really effectively that way. I liked the whole march to the cliff or the cave that eventually he goes up and the Wicker Man's there, when they're all dressed in the costumes. And it is really jarring to see Christopher Lee in drag. I mean, because that is a woman he is dressed as. It's not like a character. It's just bizarre.
See, it didn't throw me off because he looked kind of like his Hammer horror Dracula,
yeah.
To me, mm-hmm. with the black hair back and all of that. And so I was kind of like, oh, okay, it's just Dracula with his hair
down. With long hair.
So
and a dress. Yeah. That's
but he is really but I can say, film. Yeah, I think, again, it's that bittersweet kind of thing. I mean, if it to me, if you know, because he had, because the character of Captain Howie, which, by the way, I would have changed the character's name. I don't see Policeman Howie being very masculine to me, or making me think of strong policemen. But because he went to the library and actually, you know, told us the last part of the movie, then it kind of made that work for me. Because I could see what was happening then, and he wasn't, and it was kind of, that was very, to me, you know, Anthony Schaffer kind of writing, because, oh, here we all know the puzzle, but the characters don't, and so we're watching him fall into his own trap, right, kind of thing, which I liked, and I did like that procession, and then using the Stonehenge area, and then of course the whole thing of trying to, you know, finally being at the Wicker Man, what was cool, but to me not scary. I was just going, yeah, okay, well, they're going to fry him. Yeah, he's toast. Maybe he'll get out, but we don't know. I did like the six-sided sword thing. I had never seen that before, and that was really cool. The six swords forming the pentagram, and then put your head.
Yeah, it's off of the tarot card.
Right, yeah. And then put your head inside it. I was like, whoa, yeah, okay. No, that's kind of cool.
Yeah.
I thought of you. I mean, one of my keys is Tim. It's one of my keys is you. Because the lady
Tim
making
often
her
sacrificed
daughter.
Sacrificed in the past.
Yeah. No. It's before that. It's the lady trying to make her daughter, you know, swallow the toad. Or the
frog or okay, when did I ever do that?
And I was just thinking you would love that scene. As soon as I saw it, I go, oh, God, this is like it was written by Tim. Tim wrote this whole scene about, no, put it in, darling. Put it in your mouth. Okay, go ahead.
Actually,
now that old frog has your croak or whatever.
I probably have a nephew out there that will accuse me of that. Now that I think about it. We've fallen into the Wicker Man hole and kind of lost our formatting a little bit. I did want to talk about casting because I thought the casting was great in this film. I could watch Christopher Lee do just about anything. I mean, he's just a classic horror actor. And it's not surprising that this movie is often confused for a Hammer film because he's in it. But you'll be surprised, or actually probably not surprised at all, to know that he tried to get Peter Cushing to play Howie. And I thought Peter Cushing would have been good too. Both of them are a little old to be virginal, but I could buy it. I bought it with Edward Woodward. I bought it hands down with him.
I bought it with Edward Woodward. Yeah. I bought it, with him, definitely.
But he had conflicts. That's why he's not in the film. He had other obligations, I guess, to Hammer. I don't know. But he was busy. Robin Hardy, the director, originally wanted Michael York. And Michael York was unavailable. And he would have been much more... He would have been much easier to imagine being virginal because he does have a real innocent look to him, especially back when he was younger.
But I don't know if he could have played the actual, you know, by the book
cop.
So straightforward cop role.
He's not
which
really,
I thought Woodward did really well.
Right, and that was around the time he was doing Cabaret. Which he looks really young in, so it would have been a little misleading. I think Edward Woodward was a good catch for that role. One other young person that they wanted, though, and this is not going to mean anything to you until we get a few episodes in the future, but David Hemmings was considered. Do you know who David Hemmings is?
Yeah.
Well,
where did I see him last?
Well, you're going to see him in Deep Red because he is in Dario Argento's Deep Red, which we are going to cover before the end of this season.
Ooh, yeah. But I remember him from something I've seen. I can't remember it right now. But yeah, I know who David Hemmings is.
Yeah. And then the writer and producer, Schaefer and Snell, recommended Woodward after, I guess, Peter Cushing turned him down and Michael York was unavailable. And that's how Woodward landed mm-hmm. the role. And for those of you who don't know who Edward Woodward is, the easiest thing an American would know that he did was the show The Equalizer that ran on television for several seasons in 80s, 90s, was it?
Yeah, I think I always equated it to it's the evil Matlock for anybody, you know, the elderly set.
There you go.
You know, because everybody was so into Matlock at the time, or and this was he was essentially an old equalizer, which means he took on people's cases and meted out justice, vigilante justice kind of thing, right?
Right.
Wasn't that it?
Yeah, I didn't really watch it, but I'll buy that. Yeah. I just knew who he was. I don't have other alternates really with the cast, but I would like to say a few things. Obviously, Lord Summerisle is Christopher Lee, amazing mm-hmm. horror icon. Miss Rose was someone named Diane Salento, who's a pretty well-known British actress. She was the librarian? No, she was Summerisle's, I guess, wife or partner or whatever.
Who was the librarian too? That was the same.
The librarian was Ingrid Pitt, and she is a Hammer actress.
Yes.
She did The Vampire Lovers.
Oh, yeah.
She was in a lot of like Hammer type films as far as horror.
Yeah.
And then Willow was Britt Eklund, which we mentioned before. What's really funny is that this movie's set in Scotland, but none of these people are Scottish. You've got some people from England.
Right.
You've got Willow, who is Swedish, and Ingrid Pitt, who is Polish. I thought that was hilarious.
But Willow, who is Britt Eklund, is obviously dubbed, too. That is not her voice.
It's not her voice.
So it's,
and she was pregnant.
It's not her butt, and it's not her voice.
Yeah.
So, you know.
Britt Eklund is...
Only half of her was in this movie.
Yeah, only half. The upper half, because she was pregnant.
The upper half.
Right. So she did nude dancing with her tits out, but she wouldn't let them film her from below. But then when, you know, she turns around and she's shaking her ass, that's not her. And she was really mad that they did that. And when fans bring her pictures to sign of her naked double... She refuses and says, "That's not me," which I thought was really funny.
Well, yeah, it makes sense.
She is.
I'm not going to sign someone else's butt. So there. Yeah.
She's probably more famous for being the wife of Peter Sellers. She had Lou Adler's child. That's who she was pregnant with in the movie. And then she also dated Rod Stewart, for those of you who remember.
Yeah, wasn't she Rod Stewart before Peter Sellers, or was Peter Sellers before Rod Stewart?
I don't know. These foreign women and all their men.
These Swedish girls.
These Swedish girls.
Oh, no.
They won't let their bottoms be filmed. I want to film your bottom. And that, I think that does it for casting, except that The Preacher is a cameo by Robin Hardy, the director. So,
okay.
But it's a pretty solid cast, especially in retrospect. I mean, because we know a lot of these folks from other movies. So,
I mean, I really think, Woodward is great all the way through it. He, you know, he's, for what is written and what he's doing, I think he's very believable. He's very good. He plays it really well. Christopher Lee is great in it. His voice has always been so strong anyway. Mm-hmm. And to see him, he doesn't play this as an evil character. That's what makes it work so well for me for him. He plays it like, no, this is what we believe. Mm-hmm. There's nothing wrong with it. Mm-hmm. It is what it is. Even when he's telling him, you know, the hunter has become the hunted and everything else. He's not like, "Mua, my evil plan." He's like, "And yes, you're going to help us revive our crops. Because that's the way this works," kind of thing, which I thought was great.
Yeah.
Wasn't very impressed with Britt, other than her boobies. But I thought the school teacher was really good, and also thought Ingrid Pitt was good as the his wife.
Vice versa. You mean vice versa. Ingrid Pitt was the librarian, and his wife was Diane Cilento. I love that scene with Diane Cilento at the very beginning where she's I think she is a school teacher. She's talking to the class about penises. And I love his expression. Oh, yeah. And he's like, "What are you teaching these children?"
Yeah. And she's like, "What does the maypole represent? The maypole represents the penis." And, and you can imagine, that's why I'm saying if I had felt he was a little bit even more religious, then that scene would have had a lot more power to him, because he's like, of all the people to say penis in front of, it would not be this gentleman.
Yeah.
You know.
And I think as a character, he was trying to relay some of that with like his dress, you know, being perfect, everything tucked in, everything buttoned, you know, he was, you know, very pristine and old school, you know, tradition. But
Yeah.
One of my thoughts I wrote down was that the whole beginning when he lands the plane and he comes and he's standing out there with a megaphone, just it plays like Monty Python to me. You in that boat.
Oh, very much.
Come pick me up.
I would like send me a dinghy. Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty funny. Like, before we get on to Keys, did you have any other scenes that stand out? I mean, obviously, the ending is probably the most powerful.
Well, and again, I have issue with the ending because, I mean, I'm sorry. If I see somebody is going to put me in a great big wicker basket and set me on fire, I'm knocking the hell out of everybody running away. You're not going to just pick me up and carry me up there with me saying Jesus Christ. You're going to have to knock me out and put me in this thing.
Well, that's true.
Hell no, if that was going to happen. I don't know. I guess overall, I think there is a thematic here that works, which is this isolated culture developing its own mythology, and then somebody from the outside world comes into it, and you either absorb them into it, like they kind of did in Midsommar, or you use them, and you realize that it's all this big plot, and you're actually part of the feast or whatever, you know, that kind of thing. That I think touches us really primally. You know, it is a very, anything paganistic seems to be very primal, very, we're not supposed to be that way anymore. We're civilized now, kind of thing. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that really, that comes out in this, I think, as it slowly dawns on him. At first, he's like skeptical going, you know, what is wrong with you people, you know, kind of thing. And he kind of blows it off, but he's offended by it. But then slowly, as it gets worse and worse, he starts, you can see it hitting him with this, oh my God, these people are really crazy. They're going to cut somebody's head off with these swords right now. Even though he's got a mask on, you can see how concerned he is about that.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's a very primal thing of, people left to their own devices tend to create this, you know, and whether it is paganism or David Koresh or Charles Manson or whatever, these cloistered cults that kind of develop their own mythology kind of thing. Except this was based on like real mythology, right? I mean, I thought Schaeffer like wrote it around actual, like that really is a sun god and that really is an earth god or whatever.
Sorry, I just hit my microphone.
Celtic.
From
old Celtic religion.
I can't remember specifically, but I was watching a behind the scenes where Schaeffer or Hardy Wan was talking to Christopher Lee about something to do with pagan rituals, and Christopher Lee immediately went, "Oh, you mean druids?" And he, it almost you know, deflated his balloon because he thought he was onto something that no one would know. And Lee had already studied stuff about druids and sacrifice and stuff.
Right. Right. So evidently, I think the basis of it was actual old Celtic mythology, which is, you know, which to some people could be even more, even scarier. I kept trying to, after I watched it, I kept trying to say, okay, what if it was 73? But I was going, this is 1973, for God's sake. I mean, The Godfather came out a year before this. This was Papillon and all these incredible, great, big, huge movies. And people think this is a cult classic?
Well, and this movie, this movie didn't cost a lot to make. And Christopher Lee didn't make a penny. He didn't take a salary because he wanted it to be made.
Right. But yeah, I mean, but I got more scared and nervous when I watched Deliverance, which was released the same year as this,
I think.
You know, of course, but maybe that's because that's my Appalachian fear.
Well, I mean, that's fearful for various reasons, if you want to break it down. It's scary, Deliverance, that is scary because they're isolated. They're in territory unknown. They're in danger. Same reasons in The Wicker Man. He's isolated. He's definitely in unknown territory. And even more so in The Wicker Man, there's way more of them than there are of him. So he can fight all he wants. They're going to put him in that thing. And I think that's what scares me the most, not being able to get away, not being knowing it's inevitable that you're going to die because these crazy people think their pumpkins will be larger, you know? I don't know. It's always, maybe it's something deeply rooted within me and religion. Something about that just really creeps me out, that somebody could think that doing that's going to make things better.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, how do you feel then about like animal sacrifice? Like people who, you know, sacrifice pigs in India or goats or whatever.
I think it's, it's horrifying. Why do that? It doesn't amount to anything. I mean, unless you're eating the animal. Here, God, I'm going to kill this animal so I can eat it. I mean, obviously we eat animals and there is a madness to that too, I guess. I don't know. But it's not because of religious reasons that we eat animals. We eat animals because we just always have.
Yeah, but even the symbology of Christianity, I mean, that is a human sacrifice for all of us.
Right.
I mean, that is what, you know, what Christ did. And every Sunday, Catholics practice drinking his blood and eating his flesh. In remembrance of his sacrifice. So, I mean, it may be something that's intrinsically like in your psyche of that disturbs you, you know, kind of like my thing with clowns.
Well, the whole wine and bread thing as a symbol to me is just, you know, pomp and circumstance, whatever. It's just a ceremony. It's a show. That doesn't bother me. But then again, I also haven't been in a church in 20 years, probably. So,
but you're saying if they actually sacrificed a human sacrifice every week,
I would be out the door. I would be like, fuck this shit. See ya.
Oh, but Tim, it's your lucky day. Mm-hmm. You've been chosen. Right. You know, yeah. You might come back as a zombie, though, so that would be even better. You could eat other people.
No, I would rather survive with zombies because I want to be able to talk about it.
Oh, well, there you go.
I want to see it from a human perspective.
Okay, so I have very few keys. Okay. I'm sure you have much more than I, but I have a few. One that got me was as soon as I realized after about the third scene that his name was Sergeant Howie, all I could think of was Captain Howdy. From Exorcist, which was also around the same time. Wasn't Exorcist in 73?
It sure was. Too? Yeah.
So same time. But, you know, Captain Howdy was how Pazuzu appeared to her, kind of thing. So that was one of my keys. And then my only big major one, which I'm sure you have too, was this was so Clive Barker to me. This reminded me of one of his short stories where the guys find the whole town makes a big body thing, and then it destroys itself or whatever.
Yeah, it's called In the Hills, the Cities. It's the name of the
story. Yeah, very pagan, you know, Scottish, Celtic, whatever kind of storytelling. Mm-hmm. But really reminded me of that.
Absolutely. That came to mind immediately. And it is a large man, basically made of people, roped together. This is just a large man. Yeah, made of sticks. But yeah,
and they fight the other town or whatever.
Yeah, two towns battle each other as giant stick figure type thing. Yeah, that's a great story. It's one of my favorite Barker stories, and it was in my keys
Mine too.
Yeah.
Oh, cool. Mm-hmm. I got a horror key.
Yeah. I have a lot, and they're all over the place, so I'm not really sure where to start.
You just start wherever.
Well, let's go literary first, because I have several of those. Summer Isle's animal poem is based on a Walt Whitman poem, so that's plucked out of American literature. Which is ironic because it's a European film. And Walt Whitman, you know, wrote Leaves of Grass. He was very free spirit. He was gay. He was a lot like Henry David Thoreau, you know, one with nature, that type. So there's a little key within that, too, in that he was in tune with nature, which is what a lot of pagan belief is. There are some authors out there, Arthur Machen or Machen, I think it's Arthur Machen, wrote a story called The Great Machen. God Pan that was, what you could call a folksy horror kind of pagan story. And it often makes the top 10 list of favorite short stories for horror authors, and Stephen King in particular. So that one stuck out in my head. But then again, you mentioned In the Hills, the Cities by Clive Barker. I also was thinking of Rawhead Rex by Clive Barker. Terrible movie, but the story is about someone unearthing an old demon from beneath a rock that's out in a cornfield. Oh, that just reminded me of something else. Damn, man, they keep popping out.
Mm-hmm. It's popping. Yeah. They're popping.
And then another one is a writer many people won't be familiar with that you've heard me talk about, and that's Carl Edward Wagner. He was from Knoxville. Actually, he may have been from North Carolina, but he grew up in Knoxville, and he wrote a story called Styx that is along the lines of pagan horror as well.
That seems very familiar to me, but I don't know why.
Well, he only had two
Maybe
books.
Maybe I've read it at some point.
You may have, because I have copies of it, and I used to give them to people. A lot of his stuff is out of print.
Okay, I might have then.
Yeah, a lot of his stuff's out of print. There's a James Bond, there's a big James Bond key here. Britt Eklund and Christopher Lee were both in Man with the Golden Gun 2 years later. She was the girl and he was the villain.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, wow.
Yep.
That's a crazy coincidence right there.
That's very true. I'd forgotten that, but that's true. They were both in that.
Well, and Diane Salento, the teacher that you like, was Sean Connery's wife. So there's your,
no,
there's your Scottish
I did not
connection
know that at
right
all.
There. I don't know. She was once married to him. I mean, it wasn't his forever wife. But, yeah, so there's the Scottish connection right there. She was married to a Scot.
That's great. Yeah. That's great, lad.
There was a sequel written to this movie in 1989.
I saw that. Wicker Tree? Wicker, wasn't it? Or something?
Well, the one...
I didn't see the movie, but...
Well, it never came out. So you may have seen a different one.
Oh.
This one was written by Schaefer again, and its title was The Loathsome Lambton Worm. It was never shot, but you can see a treatment with illustrations in a companion book called Inside the Wicker Man. So I'm curious about that. I may have to find a copy of that.
I am too. Mm-hmm. Because I had read that, what's his name, the director guy,
Robin Hardy,
had done a sequel, and it was called The Wicker Tree.
Maybe he did.
And actually filmed it.
But, I mean, it wasn't written by
Schaefer,
I don't remember
ever seeing it, but I read about it, so.
I'm not really sure. But now you got me wanting to look.
Okay, I would have to look that up.
There was one in 2011 called The Wicker Tree.
Yep, I think that's it.
Wow, I mean, that's a long time.
And he directed it.
Wow, you are right. I did not know all this, but I am looking at this right now.
Here. See, that was my key. Ha, ha, ha.
Oh, my God, though. Even on IMDb, it only gets 3 stars. That's not good. So, yeah.
You know, I never look at those ratings. That's so weird. It's like when people tell me Rotten Tomatoes ratings, I don't know what that means.
Yeah. I
know that.
I don't really go by IMDb, but most of what I like on IMDb is above a 7. This is a 3.8. That's kind of scary. With Rotten Tomatoes, I usually go above 70 or 80. If you go above 90, I think it's certified fresh. Or 85, maybe. That's how I chose a lot of our stuff for the list for next year. I made sure they rated highly because I didn't want to give us a bunch of stinkers. So, anyway. Back to keys. Thomas Tryon, wrote a book called Harvest Home, which was made into a movie called The Dark Secret of Harvest Home, which is pretty much pagan horror right there. I remember it as a kid. I don't remember it very well as an adult. Do you?
I vaguely remember the title, yeah. Mm-hmm. But I don't remember the movie at all. No.
The movie was, I think it might have actually been a miniseries for TV. I want to say it was like 2 nights. But Stephen King wrote a story called Children of the Corn, which is what I would consider pagan horror.
Very pagan horror. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And he recently did one with his son that's on Netflix right now called In the Tall Grass. And if you've not seen that, you'll know exactly what I mean.
It is on my list, but I have not seen it yet. No.
It is a weird movie, but it is definitely in the same vein of this kind of stuff. Not a bunch of people, but definitely a pagan type god. Yeah. What else have I got? I've got 3 here I've never seen, but looking at them, I now want to see them because they're all highly rated. One is called Apostle. It came out in 2018.
Okay.
Which is funny because, you know, it's not too long before Midsommar came out. And then there's one called Kill List and Field in England, and they are both directed by Ben Wheatley. Wheatley, that's funny. And they are both, according to my research in this genre, I don't know, and I can't recommend them because I've not seen them, but they do all 3 get high ratings, so I'm curious about those. I think Apostle may be on our list.
It might be. It sounds vaguely familiar, but I can't really recall.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've got in here Witch, of course, and I mentioned it already, but it reminded me, I mean, there was a lot of that feel in there to Wicker Man as a key. And obviously, you know, Midsommar we've talked about.
Midsommar is a huge one.
But it seems like, and I don't know if it really works, but it seems like there were also several other, like, late 60s, early 70s devil cult movies. You know, I see like The Devils or something. I don't even remember any of the names because I don't think I watched any of them at the time.
One of them was called Race with the Devil. I think it had Peter Fonda and Warren Oates in it.
Okay.
But I purposefully did not include those because you remember we were talking earlier about I feel like pagan horror is a little different from satanic horror.
Agreed. And that's why if it says like, you know, tears of the devil, then it's probably, you know, more satanic and not, you know, witchy or whatever. Yeah.
I think Bava, either Bava or Fulci did one called Lisa and the Devil. It's got Telly Savalas in it.
Yeah.
I won't go down that hole. You mentioned The Exorcist. There's a scene in this movie that reminds me of a movie that came out 3 years later called The Omen.
Oh, yeah.
Speaking of Satan, when they open that girl's grave and they find a bunny rabbit. A dead rabbit in it.
Yep.
Just like when they open Damien's mother's grave, they find the skeleton of a jackal in it.
Right.
I thought that was interesting.
Yep, that's a very good one.
We mentioned Lovecraft's Cthulhu mythos. I do feel like Dunwich Horror is loosely connected to this because it's a cult kind of thing with the old ones.
Mm-hmm.
But the biggest key I think that I saved for last is a little Shirley Jackson story called The Lottery.
Yeah, very pagan and very true. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I got more scared reading that than I did watching this movie, though. You know, I got more tense. I guess I would be even more tense watching, like, The Crucible, you know, than I would in this movie. It just did not scare me in the least. I was like going, mm-hmm. Okay, show her boobs again or something. I don't know what's going on. Let's go.
Well, it's not that long of a movie. It's certainly not 2.5 hours like Midsommar. It's only about 90 minutes. So at least, you know, it doesn't go on too long.
Right.
Which is probably what Michael... what's his face, Dealey, cut out probably a lot of nonsense is what I'm thinking.
Hopefully.
Or I mean, Roger Corman, for that matter.
Yeah, I mean, you could also do without, you know, the first two songs and get rid of those, and it would be, you know, 78 minutes or whatever. I don't know, but yeah.
It won a few awards. The Academy of Science Fiction, Fantasy, and Horror Films gave it Best Film, and gave it Best Actor, and gave it Best Director.
Really?
So there's a little bit of accolade right
there.
Wow. And it was nominated for writing and music. And guess what list it's on?
It's on the 1,000, is it?
1,001 movies to watch before you die.
Woohoo!
So,
we are going to cover all the genre ones on there. I'm just telling you. We're going to do it.
I think so. So, that's a pretty much what I have for the film. Thanks for indulging me because it is a personal favorite of mine.
Yeah. And I'm sorry. I just don't like it as much. You know, I would definitely say go Exorcist instead of go this. And they're done the same year, because it's ironic.
Or Midsommar.
It's ironic because Exorcist still, as I've said, you know, when we covered it, you know, is still probably the scariest movie I've ever seen. And it just really affected me, but this one did not, but it is a classic that everyone, you know, horror fans definitely, I think, should see. So you don't go like I did 35 years or whatever and think you saw it.
That's funny. Yeah. I had assumed you saw it maybe when I saw it at UT. I didn't know.
Yeah. And I think, you know, probably I saw Dunwich and just somehow crossed them in my head. You know, because even when we were talking about Wicker Man earlier, when we were planning this episode and we were talking about Wicker Man, I kept seeing Dean Stockwell when I was thinking of Wicker Man with the same hair. With Christopher Lee. And Christopher Lee's not even in the damn movie.
No, but Dean Stockwell's hair is kind of crazy, like that wig that Christopher Lee's wearing.
True.
I think that's a wig.
True.
And I will say that Dunwich Horror has its share of stupid stuff in it as well.
Yeah.
And terrible special effects.
Right. But it's Lovecraft, so it has some cool stuff to it, too. But, yeah.
So there we go.
Human sacrifice.
For the masses.
Think about that this Sunday when you go to church.
Yeah.
Well, Tim, I hope they don't come I hope they don't come for you in the night and want you to, you know, investigate Rowan Morrison.
I'll put like yellow ointment on my nipples and dress me in a shroud and right. Lay me off to be burned alive.
Don't let that happen.
Yeah.
Don't let it happen.
No. Mm-mm. I'm going to try to avoid that.
All right. And we'll talk next time.
And then what is up next? Oh, we're back in sci-fi territory.
Oh, we're in incredibly great sci-fi territory next week. Yeah.
Okay.
So,
would you like to give them a hint or no?
No, they have to come back and listen to us. Okay. So,
there we go.
Next Monday, come and listen. You'll love it.